Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a withdrawal conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Withdrawal, as in removal of a drug that causes physical and psychological symptoms. I want to talk about cannabis withdrawal from the THC in the marijuana plant. But first, let's review more familial withdrawals. Alcohol withdrawal has a range. People can have cravings to shaking, seizures, or worse. People can die from severe alcohol withdrawal. I can't count how many patients I've admitted to the hospital for alcohol withdrawal and many to the ICU. Opioid withdrawal also has a range. Opioid withdrawal feels horrible. People can have anxiety, agitation, sweating, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and worse. On rare occasion, we need to admit people to the hospital with opioid withdrawal when the standard buprenorphine does not work. As bad as it is, opioid withdrawal is not as deadly as severe alcohol withdrawal. Opioid drugs such as heroin and fentanyl work as agonists on the opioid receptors. Agonist drugs turn on the receptors. They are the key that opens the receptor door in the brain. Buprenorphine is a partial agonist to the opioid receptor. It only partly turns on the receptor. That's how it helps withdrawal symptoms and does not cause addiction. What about cannabis withdrawal? If I ask patients if they can stop smoking weed or use cannabis, they almost always say, sure, no problem. But then they're back in the emergency department the next week or month. I change my approach. Instead of asking if they can stop, I explain what withdrawal feels like. 100% of my patients who come in the emergency department daily with cannabis hyperemesis syndrome have an addiction. They all have a cannabis use disorder that resulted in the terrible abdominal pain and vomiting, commonly known as scromiting, screaming and vomiting. They don't think they're addicted, but they listen intently when I explain withdrawal symptoms. Anxiety is a key symptom of cannabis withdrawal. People think they're using marijuana to chill, but at some point, they're using it to cover up withdrawal. Chronic marijuana use messes up the REM sleep cycle. You get to sleep faster, but you have poor quality of sleep. So when you're withdrawing to cannabis, it really messes up your sleep. Cannabis withdrawal can lead to headaches, depression, and other symptoms that last about 2 weeks. If we give cannabis withdrawal patients benzodiazepines for anxiety or sleep aids for insomnia, they become at risk for worse addiction to those medications. Unfortunately, there are currently no approved medications to help with cannabis withdrawal symptoms. Patients are asked to understand what is happening and just tough it out. I recently read about a new promising medication that was designed to treat cannabis withdrawal. Of course, I was instantly intrigued. To learn more about potential medications for cannabis withdrawal, I reached out to Dr. Ginger Constantine. Dr. Ginger Constantine is the chairperson and CEO of Pleo Pharma, which is developing a new drug directed at cannabis withdrawal. She has over 25 years of pharmaceutical, regulatory, and clinical development expertise with approval of more than 15 products. To learn more about Dr. Ginger Constantine and Pleo Pharma, check out the High Truth show notes. I recorded this conversation with Dr. Constantine on March 5th, 2025. Dr. Ginger Constantine, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you. Happy to be here. Very happy to be here.
Yes, I'm excited, very, very excited to hear about your new innovations. And let's start with your personal journey. You're a physician became a doctor? What made you become a doctor? And how did that happen for your path to become in drug development?
Oh, wow. Very circuitous, very interesting pathway, like all of us in medicine. As a little kid, I wanted to be a nurse. And then I decided, I think I'll become a doctor. First I wanted to be a veterinarian, but then I decided I wanted my patients to be able to talk to me. So I became a doctor. I became a rheumatologist, internist rheumatologist by training, and practiced medicine. And I had a very good friend who was in pharmaceuticals industry, and she kept saying, you should join industry. You use both sides of your brain there. It's really cool. You can be creative. You like being strategic. And one day, you know, I answered a call and that was all she wrote. So I went into industry, and I was fortunate enough to really work on a lot of products and have over 15 in the U.S. that we have been able to have approved. So it's been a great journey.
Wow. Tell us about some of these other products. What were they?
I'm a rheumatologist, internist, so most of them were in the arthritis space. And then a lot of them were in women's health. So I did a lot of products for vasomotor symptoms and for vaginal atrophy and all sorts of other areas. So addiction was new to me when I realized that we have a huge problem in this country and a huge and growing problem, and it needs to be addressed.
Yes. And you're CEO and chairperson of Pleo Pharma. Was that a glass ceiling to break?
I've never had any problems. I mean, I co-founded the company with my husband, so I didn't have to break a glass ceiling. We created our ceiling.
Wow, that's great. So you learned everything and just decided to do it on your own. And your focus is what I was attracted or reached out to speak to you was about cannabis withdrawal. So let's talk about a little bit about withdrawal symptoms. And are there specific symptoms, you know, when we get to the drug that helps with that you're specifically focusing on? I mean, cannabis withdrawal lasts usually about 2 weeks, anxiety, sleep disorder, headaches, and other things. And is it kind of looking at all the gamut? And even when did you realize that that was such a big issue?
So I'll start with that part of the question first.
Okay.
So my husband and I are both physicians. I'm a rheumatologist internist. He's an endocrinologist internist. And as you know, when you're a physician, many people come across your doorstep who have medical problems for various reasons, and they're looking for help or asking you for advice. And around mid-2019, interestingly, three people came to our attention who were really in rip-roaring withdrawal. And, you know, my husband and I looked at each other and said, wait a second, cannabis isn't supposed to be addicting or have withdrawal. And I have to tell you, I'm really embarrassed that I didn't know. And so we were trying to find a product to help these folks. And just, there's got to be something out there. And started looking at the medical literature and realized that there was a huge medical literature that existed on cannabis use disorder and cannabis withdrawal. There had been a lot of products that had been tested and tried in research, but everything had failed. And so with my clinical development and regulatory background from industry and my husband's endocrinology background, because the endocannabinoid system is so similar to hormone systems, we put our heads together to try and come up with something that would work. So that's how we started the company. And then at that point, we really started looking at withdrawal and the symptoms of withdrawal, which, as you listed, are things such as anxiety, cravings, and the cannabis withdrawal is codified in the DSM-5, the Diagnostics and Statistical Manual of Mental Illnesses. And so cannabis use disorder is codified in that, as is cannabis withdrawal. And so we looked at all of those symptoms and then started testing to see what was most important to people and what they really needed help with. And it really is a small cadre of, you know, a long list of symptoms that people can have. So I know that was a long answer to your question.
No, but that's important. And so the Pleo Pharma was created really focused on this one problem to start out with. Is that right?
To start out with, yeah, it was, we created it to find a product for cannabis withdrawal in people who have cannabis use disorder. The more we started looking and the more we saw people who have these conditions, the more we realized this is a serious condition. This isn't just get over it, you'll be fine in 2 days. They're not fine in 2 days and they cannot stop. And it's really creating the recidivism that happens with cannabis and they just can't stop. We've been surprised along this journey at how difficult it actually is for people to stop. We knew it was hard, but we didn't know it was quite this hard. And we've also realized how serious it is. And interestingly, the FDA just granted us fast track designation about 2 weeks ago, which, and fast track designation means that there's an unmet need and that it's serious. And so the FDA also recognizes the issue that's occurring now because of, and we can talk about why we think we're seeing it.
Yeah, definitely a problem. So how did you come up with the name Pleo Pharma?
Every other name was taken. So Pleo means pleomorphic, and there's every person from every walk of life can get addicted to cannabis. And so I liked that pleomorphic approach, and it was going to be a pleomorphic approach to a product to help.
Ah, there you go. I knew there was a reason. You know what? I recently heard a statistic about, you know, they say, you know, usually the marijuana industry says, oh, it's better than alcohol. But in fact, people can have, you know, a glass of wine and not become the heavy consumer with the alcohol use disorder. But now with the, like, I think like 1 in 10 drinkers or have, you know, become an having an alcohol use disorder. But now with the high potency products, they're more potent and they have create more addiction, right? Like just having higher nicotine count, products have more. And so that addicting potential for marijuana now of that, like the daily regular high intensity users is actually more than for alcohol. So it is a big problem.
Well, the things, if you wanted to have a perfect storm for an addiction, we have it. Because we have increased potency, and we know the increased potency of products, no matter what it is, can lead to addiction. Now, not everybody gets addicted. Not everybody is dependent. Not everybody gets addicted to cannabis. Our product is focused on those people who have the dependence addiction and who want to stop. So it doesn't happen in everybody, just like alcohol. Not everybody gets addicted to alcohol. So, but the issues that we're seeing with cannabis, which is very interesting, is that we have higher potency, we have higher daily use. So the number of people who are using daily, near daily, has quadrupled in the last 2 decades. And it's finally crossed, it's more common for daily, near daily use than alcohol. And that just happened about a year ago. And these are numbers that are not our numbers. These are from HHS, SAMHSA, the Division of Health and Human Services of the US government. So we've got potency, we've got frequency, we have acceptability because a lot of people think it's good for them. So, you know, a lot of kids, a lot of people get addicted and they don't know they're doing something that's potentially harmful. And we have accessibility because, you know, and NIH has a slide that shows the number of cannabis stores in 2018, say in Colorado and Oregon, were more than McDonald's and Starbucks put together.
Yeah, crazy.
So we have the perfect storm for people to unfortunately become addicted if they have a predilection for it.
Yeah. And, you know, as an emergency physician, every shift I take care of marijuana poisoning, every single shift from cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, scromiting, 100% of those people have a cannabis use disorder, to psychosis, to taking a gummy and having sedation, babies, and even people who are, you know, are not there for poisoning, you know, when I ask about drug use, they'll say, oh, I just take a gummy once in a while to sleep. And I don't think they understand what it really does to ruin your sleep cycle. Like it decreases sleep latency. So you sleep faster and you feel, oh, that's good for you. But it takes away your REM sleep and your quality of sleep is bad. So one of the things that we've seen in sleep labs is people withdrawing have horrible time with their sleep.
Mm-hmm. And that is one of the major symptoms that and that the product was effective for in our phase one and phase two studies. So it really did help with sleep. And it's not only the number of hours that somebody sleeps, to your point, it's the quality of sleep that they have as well. I just want to back up a minute because you mentioned, and I know from looking at your bio, that you are an emergency room doctor treating a lot of folks who are really struggling with addiction. And I just really want to thank you for doing that because, you know, I remember what it was like to be on the front lines, and it's not easy what you do. So
Thank you. It can be rough, but it's rewarding. And we all have personalities that fit that profession that we go into. So I wouldn't want to do anything else. The other type of patients I see also, the ones that you said, oh, it helps, you know, I need a little bit to help me sleep or I need it to help relax. And that's very common to what we hear about, you know, alcohol addiction, nicotine addiction, opioid addiction. I need it to calm down to feel normal because you are addicted and you're actually treating your withdrawal symptoms, not your anxiety.
You're exactly correct. And there was an article that came out not too long ago looking at anxiety. And when they asked people, you'll hear people say, oh, I'm using it to treat my anxiety. But when they asked them, were you anxious before you started using cannabis? The answer was no. And the study actually looked at and found that it increased anxiety, did not decrease it. So it's very problematic because people honestly believe that they're treating an underlying condition such as sleep or anxiety or depression, when in fact, in many people, it is not helping them. It is making things worse.
Yeah. So let's talk about this drug, PP01. What is it?
So it's a dual mechanism of action product. When we started looking back at some of the products that had failed in development, we realized that almost all of the products looked either at the CB1 receptor that THC, the active moiety, binds to, or it was looking at the downstream mesolimbic reward system. And we know that the brain is very complicated. And so from the endocannabinoid system downstream to the neurotransmitters, that we have to integrate our products so that we can't just treat one site and not the other. So what we did was we combined a couple of agents, one of which is not available in the U.S., and we combined products into combination capsules and have done a taper and titration. So our point is not to substitute the product for cannabis. We're not looking for substitution therapy. We're looking to help people, if they want to stop, to help them to stop their cannabis, or in some cases decrease if their doc is looking at harm reduction.
So one of the things I think, you know, speaking to you earlier, that it is, it's two drugs. One is a CB receptor partial agonist. Is that right?
That's correct. So basically that is mimicking THC. But this product, the patients don't like as well as they like cannabis. So they're less likely to become addicted to it. And the way we give the product, they taper off of it. And so we're allowing those receptors, which are downregulated from all the years of THC, we're allowing those receptors to slowly upregulate. And at the same time, we're making people comfortable by treating that reward center.
Okay. So the chemical, the CB1 partial agonist, is that brand new? Did you cook it up in a lab, or was that around?
It's an older product. We're using it in a very different way. There's no product approved for cannabis withdrawal or cannabis use disorder. So we're using a very different mechanism, a very different paradigm. But there is a safety profile that exists that existed in the past. As I said, it's not available.
So was that one, that part, that one component of the PP01, was that available on the market? Is that already approved anywhere else in the world?
It is approved, but it's not available and cannot be brought into the U.S.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so that's Exic, that partial agonist, and then the other one you said works on the limbic system. What does that mean?
The mesolimbic system is the midbrain portion of the brain. There are certain structures that are considered the reward system. So it works on the GABAergic, glutamergic, and dopamine. So basically what we're doing is we are allowing dopamine levels, which is the pleasure product, to increase over time. So we're trying to feed that so that people don't suffer. If people want to stop cannabis, they shouldn't have to feel badly. People should have something available to them to help them. And so basically, we're allowing those receptors, the CB1 receptors, to upregulate. At the same time, we're treating the reward pathway, and we're doing it in a very graduated way. It's a very complicated.
Now, this other component, this is drug, has that been available around the world anywhere else? Or is that something that's brand new?
No, it has been available.
It has been done. Okay. Would that be good for other addictions too, not just cannabis?
It's been looked at. It, by itself, it doesn't work. And there have been several studies that have looked at it as monotherapy. It doesn't work. We looked at it as monotherapy in our study. It did not work. Okay. So it has failed. It has been looked at, but it has not been successful.
All right. But now you're hoping with the combination that it would work.
So in our phase one and phase two studies, the combination, there was a synergy between them.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, to bring a drug, like, I don't know about all the different drugs, but one of them that was kind of famous was Ribonabant. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right.
Got it.
Ribonabant. Okay. So that was a CB1 receptor blocker. It was a medication that people thought, oh, you know what? People who use marijuana, they get the munchies. So, and marijuana activates the CB1 receptor. So if we block it, then maybe it'll be a great weight loss drug. And it was approved around Europe. And the FDA got a lot of slack because it was available everywhere around the world and not in the United States until the FDA studies showed that it caused depression and suicidality, and doubled down that they're not going to approve the medication, and then it went off the market in Europe. So how is this different? I guess it's different one way, is that this was a CB1 blocker, and your product, the PPO1, is a partial blocker. Is that right?
No, we're an agonist. So that one was an antagonist. It antagonized the receptor. Oh. We're an agonist, so we're more similar to THC. Whereas Ribonabant, and the Ribonabant example is excellent because it's a model for withdrawal. Basically, when you block that CB1 receptor with an antagonist, mm-hmm. we antagonize that, people withdraw. That's what was happening with Ribonabant. They became depressed. They became anxious. They became suicidal. And people were dropping out of studies, weren't taking it in Europe. And the FDA were savvy enough to look at that data and realized, wait a second, we can't just block this receptor and think people are going to be okay. We actually have used that as a model to help us develop a product, this product, because we knew that if we block, that is like the last thing in the world you want to do. We're going to create withdrawal.
Right. I love that story because it's like, way to go, FDA. Like, people get, you know, they get a lot of slack, but this was an example of real consumer protection.
Well, I mean, that's what the FDA does. And I have to say, I've worked with the FDA with so many products that I've worked on over the years. And I have to say, they have a really tough job and I really respect them. So, you know.
Yeah. And there's also an irony of, like, you know, you've been working on this product now for probably years, right? And you have to go through a lot of hoops and a lot of expense and a lot of phase 1, 2, 3 studies to get it approved. And on the other hand, I'm just seeing all these new, like, hemp products, the Delta 8 and Delta 10, and they just, like, make up these new drugs and sell them at the smoke shops with no testing, no consumer protections.
And this is probably going to make me not very popular, but the concept of medical marijuana None of those products are FDA approved. None of them go through the testing or the rigor that we go through. None of them, I mean, there was just an article out a couple of weeks ago that looked at what's really in some of those products. So people think they're taking something.
And they're taking heavy metals.
They don't know what, well, or the potency is very different than what they're using. So, you know, I'll have people say, well, you could just use marijuana and decrease. No, it doesn't work. We wouldn't have 20 million people addicted to cannabis if that worked.
Yeah, well, I mean, frankly, every physician should have that point of view. You're speaking kind of in pharma, so you're thinking about the scrutiny that goes on for you to be able to sell your new medication. I look at it on the clinical point of view. As a physician, before I recommend an aspirin, a Tylenol, an amoxicillin, I have to get a history, a physical. I have to do risk and benefits. I have to check for drug interactions. I have to do all these things, document it. Before I recommend anything, how could I call that medical? This is getting, they're stealing my language. it's really affront to the medical profession to call it medicine when nothing else, it doesn't go through the clinical standards that we have in our field.
I don't know if a lot of physicians know that it's not, when they hear medical.
I don't think a lot of physicians realize that. They think that it's okay. I know because I've heard physicians treat withdrawal with like, okay, take a gummy instead of smoking. It's like, no, don't do that. Or I've heard them say use CBD instead. Studies have not shown that. And what, when you first talked, you said that you didn't know that you have such withdrawals from marijuana. And I don't think the medical community knows that either. There's a big educational gap out there.
Well, I'm a rheumatologist, treated pain. And now at the time, the high potency stuff wasn't around when I was practicing, but I did not know that people withdrew from cannabis. And when we actually saw it, we were shocked. We've seen now, a lot of people, now that they know we're doing this, we get calls all the time or, people send us information. We saw a kid with cannabis hyperemesis syndrome. And what was really interesting was, his dad called us and said, that, he had a lot of weight loss and he couldn't eat and he'd had like the $1 million workup for GI symptoms. And we said, let's just talk to him. We spoke to the kid. It turned out, it was cannabis. And we said, you have to stop.
It's classic. They're thin kids and they think, well, that I need it for my appetite, but they're throwing up and losing weight and it's causing an idiosyncratic reaction. We saw that with the opioid epidemic, right? When we were flooding people with opioids, their receptors acted erratically. And you probably understand the physiology better than I do. But what we would see is opioid hyperalgesia, people with high-dose opioids. And they're like, why does it hurt you if I just put my stethoscope on you? And they're like, ow, ow, ow. And they felt worse pain because of these opioids. So, and I feel like we're seeing the same thing now. Like, oh, it's supposed to help me with my appetite. And it's just, no, it's screwing your appetite, your stomach. You're throwing up and it's causing, that idiosyncratic opposite reaction.
Right. And what we're now seeing is a lot of the stuff that we attributed to high potency cannabis is actually a withdrawal symptom, like cannabis hyperemesis syndrome. Now, I think there probably is a dual mechanism of action, but mm-hmm. cannabis hyperemesis syndrome is now being reported as a withdrawal symptom. We're seeing it. And in our studies, patients were developing abdominal pain. There was some vomiting when they were withdrawing. And same thing with psychosis. I don't know if you saw the recent articles a couple weeks ago that really, when they really tracked when last use of cannabis was, it turned out that it was a withdrawal symptom. So one of the things, and with you working in the emergency room, I'm happy to give you, we put together a survey that we haven't implemented yet, but it would be really nice to know when last use of cannabis was, because what we know is that the residence time on the inhaled product for that high is only about 2 to 3 hours. So I know you interviewed Libby Stout, and Libby has a term that people are in a constant state of withdrawal. And what we found in our studies was after a few hours, they really started to withdraw. The withdrawal changes over time, And the symptoms seem to evolve over time. But within a couple of hours, they start getting pretty irritable and pretty angry.
You know, that goes along with the use, because if, you know, in the 70s, maybe people would, you know, smoke a joint here and there. But now people, like, every few hours, they're, you know, taking a hit, you know, all day long, that frequency.
I mean, people aren't using this to get high 20 times a day. They're using it because they start to withdraw. So in the beginning, for the first few months, it's pleasurable and they're doing it for pleasure. But then that pleasure goes away and they start having to treat their withdrawal symptoms.
Right. And that's true for all drugs of abuse, right? I'll see people who are using methamphetamine at that point in their life. They're not doing it to get high. They just get it to get out of bed, to get their dopamine level back to their baseline. But their baseline is way up high.
Right.
Yeah. So, all right. So PPO1, tell us about these phase 1, 2, 3 studies. Where are you at and what did the results show?
Okay. So we did a phase 1 study, which was the first study was inpatient. We were really nervous because we're using very high doses of things.
And explain to us phase 1. What does that mean?
So phase 1 was inpatient, where we draw blood and look at pharmacokinetics. We look at blood levels of our product. And we also looked in our phase 1 study at cannabis withdrawal symptoms. So we tested their symptoms. And so we could really monitor them very carefully. And the good thing about being inpatient was the idea with that study was they got high on the doorstep of the clinic and then came in. And our goal is to mitigate symptoms. Because the other thing we know is with that this short half-life of the residence time, we have to start treating them and making them feel better within 4 hours, or they're going to recidivate. So we needed a product that worked quickly, that and we needed them inpatient so that they weren't using. So we had a true of.
So how did you find these people who are withdrawing just from marijuana?
So these weren't people who were withdrawing. These were people who were heavy, moderate to severe cannabis use disorder people who actually agreed not to quit, except for when they were inpatient, because we did a crossover design, meaning that we had two periods. They were randomized, so we didn't know what they got. The patients didn't know what they got, and the site didn't know what they were getting. It was blinded. So they got either placebo or they got the active drug, and they were treated inpatient for 4 days, discharged on day 5, and went out and agreed that they would go back to their normal cannabis use. And then they came back 2 weeks later, and if they got our product, PPO1, in the first period, then they got placebo and vice versa. So what was very cool in that study is that they're their own control. So we watched them.
Wow.
And we watched them inpatient, and they did not have access to cannabis, obviously, once they were inpatient. So they stopped using right before they got admitted. We brought them in, and then we started treating them. The first dose was the next morning, because we were getting blood on them throughout the day. We didn't want to give it at night. And then we watched, and the symptoms really diverged between when they got placebo and when they got active. Highly statistically significantly difference within 4 hours, and they were less bothered by their symptoms. We also looked at a lot of other things like cortisol levels, which is a stress hormone, and we found that this is not just some little, you know, psychological thing. People are really physically addicted to cannabis. And so the cortisol levels were increased in the placebo when they were using placebo, but not when they were getting PPO1. So that was a really interesting study. The other thing, obviously, we were concerned about was safety. So we did a lot of safety testing on them, and it was very well tolerated, very safe. Interestingly, we were blinded through the study, and so we watch adverse events. We had two patients who were presyncopal, almost passed out during treatment, and it turned out when we unblinded, they were in the placebo group. So we breathed a sigh of relief that it's not the product, it's the withdrawal that's really making people feel so badly.
Right. If you think about it, just the thought of them not having it or getting something made them pass out.
No, it was the symptoms. They were pretty symptomatic.
Yeah. And this is, so I imagine this is all at rehab centers.
It was at a phase 1 unit. There's special units that can get blood work on people. Ah. So we found a unit that had the capacity to do the blood and to also do all the psychological stuff. And so we were really lucky to find a really good center.
So that was phase one, and it you passed. And how many patients were there?
So that was 14, but remember, they're their own controls. So
yeah.
Yeah, so it's 28.
Wow, that was very, that's clever, clever study. All right, so then you're on to phase two. Tell us, what does that mean and how did that go?
So phase two, now we're testing a dose response. So we did a high dose and a lower dose based on these tapers and titrations, very complicated schema. And this was an outpatient study. So we wanted to see if in the real world, people could tolerate the product and whether they would be able to stop using. So these are now treatment-seeking people, people who said, we want to stop. We've been trying to stop for 15 years and we can't. And we really screened them very carefully to make sure that that was their goal. And so it was an outpatient study looking, as I said, at two doses. And then we looked at the monotherapy arms and placebo. And basically, the high dose that we had tested basically in phase one was what worked in the phase two study. And so we were able to have fewer symptoms. And we also showed lower potency and cannabis use in the PPO1 patients. But our endpoint, what we're looking at, is really mitigation of withdrawal symptoms in people with cannabis use disorder. Our belief is that if you don't get those withdrawal symptoms under control, you are never going to get to use disorder because people aren't going to tolerate it.
Right. Some will, like some people can just, you know, quit alcohol or opiates, but it makes it a lot harder and you won't get a lot of people being able to do it, hence the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So that phase two check, right? You're past that?
Yep.
And now phase three.
Now we go.
That's an exciting one, huh?
Yeah, it's going to be very similar to the phase two study in this circumstance. It's not a heck of a lot different. So we go into phase three, and we're going to be looking at one study where we're looking, again, same type of endpoints. We have our own patient-reported outcome that we've worked with the FDA on having as our primary endpoint, and that's what we're taking into phase three. And the FDA is also very interested in adolescents. It's obviously a huge problem in kids, and they, you know, prolonged brain development issues in kids.
What's their definition of adolescence? What age?
12 years old to 12. Less than 18.
12 to 18. Okay.
Yeah. So we're including them in a second phase three study with adults as well. So the kids will be evaluated. We wanted to get through the first phase three study, make sure, you know, it's a larger population, make sure there's no issues, and then we'll test it in the adolescents. They have very similar symptoms, very similar findings as the adults. The problem, obviously, we worry about in adolescents is the long-term brain changes that occur.
Right. Are you noticing that what we call the anagnosia that happens with marijuana use, that people don't, they're impaired, they had a cannabis use disorder, they have withdrawals, but they do not have the self-awareness or the perception that they have this problem?
Absolutely.
No, because I thought maybe you wouldn't, because they agreed to do the study. So you have a selected population.
Well, you know, I guess in the study, I didn't ask that particular question.
Because somehow those patients that you see got over that to even come to you.
Yeah. It's interesting. The people who decided to come into the study and quit were very similar to all the other type of addiction studies. Same, the mean age was about 30. You know, we allowed people into the phase one and phase two if they were like 18 to 55, but the mean age was about 30. People get to that midpoint in their lives and they don't want to be smoking around the kids, or they need a job that where they're not allowed to have cannabis on board. The big thing we're also seeing is pregnancy, women trying to get pregnant, people who, for example, need to have surgery, because there's a lot of post-op complications now being reported in people who are using cannabis.
Absolutely.
So people who are planning surgeries are often seeking help. But, you know, it's one of the first studies. I mean, I've done clinical trials for years. One of our investigators told me that he received thank you letters from patients.
Aww.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really cool.
You know, I you know, we get there's really focus in the medical community to for smoking cessation. Like, you know, 1-800-BUZZ, they pay us, you know, whatever, $5 a patient to get people to stop smoking. And nothing. I've had people say, like, okay, is there a program? Is there a line, a help to stop marijuana? And we don't have that. It's a real huge gap.
There is Marijuana Anonymous.
But that's there's not a you know, that's more social. That's like AA. Or NA, there's MA, right? There's Alcohol Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Marijuana Anonymous. So it's a support group.
Right.
It's not a program.
Well, there's nothing out there. There's nothing available to treat
nothing.
Them. So, you know, and that's our other hope is, and that's why I'm so grateful to you for allowing me to do this podcast, is one of the big messages is education. And we need to start educating the population that, okay, it doesn't happen to everybody, but for those people where it does happen, they need to have some type of product. And we know from experience in pharma, when there's a product available, the message gets out. And so that's part of the hope too, is when and if this gets approved, that the message would be out there.
Yeah. It's interesting. I spoke to a psychiatrist recently and I said, well, can't you just have... And it was an addiction psychiatrist. Can you just help your patients not use and go on a dopamine holiday? You know, I tell my patients, because I have nothing, I say, give your body a cleanse. Just try it, you know, for a month. And he said, yeah, that could happen, but your compliance is not as good. If he was really wishing for a product. And then I learned about you. So that was amazing.
Well, you know, I think that there is a place for medication assisted treatment. And I think people should have options. And that's what we're doing.
Yeah. So phase three, now what does the fast track designation, what does that give you?
The FDA will work with us real time. And even in the short amount of time that we've been designated fast track, we've seen them do that. We had a question and they answered it within 12 hours, which, you know, is not the norm that they have to. The standard that they have to uphold. And then as the approval process goes along, they can look at things real time. They can move the approval up. Maybe it would shorten it. So it helps to work more directly with the agency and have more real-time feedback. You know, there are times when it can take a very long time to get feedback on a question.
Wow. And we're recording this at the beginning of March 2025. Where we're seeing doging of FDA in all parts of government, and you're still getting quick responses and fast tracking, and we're seeing that the agency is moving along in products and things that they think are important.
I have not, you know, I was very concerned because our meeting with the FDA was scheduled for this time frame. And we just have not seen any disruption. I can't speak to other groups, other products. I have no idea.
Yeah.
I'm sure that there are issues from what I'm hearing, but we've been fortunate enough to not experience it.
And so what's your ETA for having this available on the market?
So we're hoping that as you point out, it takes a long time and a lot of money for drug development. So we're hoping for 2028 or 2029.
Okay, so coming up. And what would be the indications?
So the indication, and you know, sometimes the FDA will work on the wording with us, with the sponsor a little bit, but it's the mitigation of cannabis withdrawal syndrome in patients with cannabis use disorder.
Okay, and so it's really for withdrawal. Does it help as a deterrent?
Yeah. Basically, if we treat the withdrawal, the whole point is to allow people to decrease or stop their cannabis. And we actually saw that in our study. Not everybody stops, but say they were using very high potency. So about by the end of our study, about 50% of people in the treatment group were not using. Versus only 3 people in the placebo group, so about 8%. So people in the placebo group just don't stop. despite the fact that they said they wanted to. And the other thing that we saw is of the people who were continuing to use in PPO1, basically they were using a lot less potent product and less frequently. So all the patients started out using pretty high potency products, pretty high. The average grams per day was about 4.5 grams. We had some people using 28 to 32 grams a day. And if you think about a joint, and depending on where you live and where you go for your cannabis and all that, a joint is between a third and a half a gram, I'm told. So think about 4.5 grams on average is a lot of cannabis use. And so the patients who were in PPO1, maybe if they had started at 28 grams a day, maybe they were using one joint a week or something like that. So that's a huge decrease for those people.
Yeah.
And that the other 50% were abstinent in those last few weeks.
And so how is this a pill? You take it once a day, twice a day, for how long? Or you were mentioning something about a taper.
It's a capsule, and it'll be given in blister packs. So that every week or so, the patients will come into their doctor and they'll have the prescription or on site, and we'll have a blister pack, and each day is labeled. So the patients, it's not as though we're just going to give them a bottle of pills and, you know, go out and treat it, you know, have fun with your friends. It's going to be very, very tightly controlled. And every few days they decrease or increase. We have tapers and titrations in opposite directions of the products. And they take it at night, just once at night before they go to bed.
So it can for how long?
It's a 34-day taper.
34 days. Interesting. And then you were saying about titrations, some people may need more or less. So it's not the same for everybody?
It is the same for everybody. But we start at a high dose on one of the components, a lower dose on the other one, build the other one up, decrease the one. So it's a...
So it could be like your birth control pills, you know, like a little pack and you have every day. Like
you got it. You got it.
Interesting. All right. So now marketing. So who is this for? Is this for ER doctors, addiction specialists?
I think it's predominantly for addiction specialists. And, you know, eventually, you know, could it go to primary care? I think that people who have addictions really need to be treated in people who have expertise in addiction medicine.
So it's not for the people, because I could see all the patients we have with cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, we pump them up with fluids, we get them better. This is not, it's too complicated to just start a blister pack.
No, they could get the blister pack.
Okay.
Because when they go home, they're gonna use again. I'm sure as an ER doc, there's an ER doc in Colorado who said she saw one person 27 times for cannabis hyperemesis syndrome. So we know that we've got to treat that withdrawal. So no, they could leave the emergency room with the pack and then follow up.
Yeah, she saw them 27 times. We have 27 CAT scans. They each time they, it's like you're gonna give yourself cancer from all that radiation that they come to. Okay, so it could be for that population, for emergency departments.
Absolutely, we see it for
okay,
that.
Okay.
I was telling you about the kid, the young adult who we saw with cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, and he really started to withdraw when he stopped. I thought I was going to wind up in a crisis unit with this kid because he kept calling and we kept checking on him, and then, you know, we got him through the couple weeks with just supportive care and sending him to urgy centers. You know, his parents were very involved with him.
How long did it take? So that guy was severe, because that's who we see. We see the worst of the worst, right? And they've been told. Most of the patients it's not their first time. They've been to the ER multiple times, multiple CAT scans, and that's like the definition of addiction. They can't stop even though they know it's harming them. So how quickly, you were mentioning with your studies, within a few hours, you feel better?
Mm-hmm. Within 4 hours, people feel better. And what we found was I looked at some data to see how predictive that initial time frame is. It's very important to really start making them feel good within that first few days.
Yeah. And I guess that specific patient population with a cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, we have to get them over the vomiting and pain. Usually we do it with antipsychotics, before I think we could probably start a new medication like that.
You could probably send them out of the ER on it.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll have to study it.
Yeah. But you'll have to study that with the interactions with the antipsychotics. Like, well, how soon can they?
I think that, once they settle down, and these are capsules, so this is not an IV formulation. They'd have to be able to hold it down. But I would think within 12 hours. But again, it's going to depend on what they're using. We have to study it. But we are looking at cannabis hyperemesis for another product. So we're very interested in it.
Yeah, that is another big need. All right, so the business of Pleopharma, you're planning to develop this for your own or to sell, or tell us a little bit about the business of drug development.
So it's complicated. We're taking a multi-prong approach with the company and this product. Obviously, we have people, we're privately funded by multiple people. And so I'm very grateful to all of those people. And we're going to do what's best for the shareholders. So we will, when we have different options, we'll go to shareholder votes. And so either we can sell it, we can license it. I want to get the product approved. I think it's really important for society. But, whoever's best at doing that.
So once you get it approved and going, it may be going to Pfizer or someone else.
Whoever can do the best with the product.
You're open.
Hat is off to them. We are totally open to what's best for the product and the shareholders.
What do you think it's going to cost for patients to buy?
For patients to buy? I think we still have to do some analyses on that. It will not be any more expensive than anything that's out there for addiction. We want to keep it reasonable. And the other thing that it will do, hopefully, is to keep people out of rehab. So we'll save a lot of money that way. There are many people who go into rehabs now. Cannabis monotherapy is now a huge reason that people are getting addicted to rehabs. And so we've had one person tell us that this will be on every rehab shelf in the country as well. So the cost difference is,
You mentioned something about monotherapy not being working. What do you mean by that?
I don't know what I said. What did I say? That
compared to monotherapy? I didn't know if you...
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Compared to rehab, inpatient rehab. So this would be outpatient. And comparing it to people going inpatient, this therapy as a monotherapy rather than rehab would save the insurance companies a lot of money.
Yeah. And it'll probably be covered by insurance. I imagine, is it fair to say it'll be kind of like the Suboxone for opiates?
Yeah, except, yes. The Americans for Disability Act consider addiction a disability. There's no product out there. So the insurance companies are supposed to cover medication-assisted treatment. Now, once there's generics and stuff like that that's out there, they can cover that. But we have patents on this product as well.
Right. And when I was looking at your website, I saw the PPO1 that we've been talking about, but I also saw PPO2, PPO3. What are these other things?
So some of it is for cannabis hyperemesis syndrome. And we're looking at psychosis and maybe a maintenance dose if people need it.
And so what are all the, are these all different dosages of the same key chemicals?
Some are different doses, some are different components, different products. We're looking at different products, like for hyperemesis.
Like what, are you, is that something that you can share? Like what kind of?
It's a little early on that one.
Okay. Is it for the vomiting or is it on the part or is it for the withdrawal part later?
So it would be both. So they could get PPO1 for the withdrawal, and for the vomiting, they would get something else to help in the emergency room.
Okay. Got it. All right. Well, very exciting. Products that are a few years away. But at least there is hope, and it's great to hear that you're working on that. So I wish you a lot of success. I know there's a huge need, and like you said, there's a huge educational gap, and as well as a treatment gap and a prevention gap. There's, but I know there's one not gap is that the product availability. That's very prevalent.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But again, hats off to you for doing everything that you do in the emergency room. And if you want that survey to be able to see when people last use their cannabis, I think it'll be really interesting that you'll be seeing how quickly these symptoms occur and the seriousness of them.
Yes, I would. I would, because I may add that to my presentations and stuff, and as well as the hope for your new products.
Thank you.
That's great. And with that, thank you so much, Dr. Ginger Constantine and Pleo Pharma. And we'll be looking out to see how things progress.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit DFAF.org. And ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.